Hello, my name's Ali, and I'm 7 years old, and you're listening to the Emperors of Rome podcast.
Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CCXLII, Glory and Gold. Crassus had power, he had money, but he still felt something was missing. With an army and a province in the east, he set off to win the glory he had always been denied. Perhaps it lay in Parthia. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
In 55 BCE, Crassus was consul for the second time. And after this, of course, after every consulship, you get the chance to be a governor, and he gets the proconsulship of Syria. And with this comes a big army, the chance for glory that he's always been waiting for.
He must have been really excited about this.
He's really overjoyed.
Yeah.
It does seem like it's from this point that Plutarch, as we'll see, he'll start to concentrate on Crassus being overly ambitious, overly sure of himself, rather than just greedy. So we're kind of moving up in terms of his bad characteristics. So to quote Plutarch, he showed his joy that he regarded no piece of good fortune in his whole life as more radiant than the one which had now come to him. Among strangers and in public, he could scarcely hold his peace, while to his friends he made many empty and youthful boasts. Youthful will be a strange thing to say there, because we're about to have it stressed just how old Crassus is at this point. And Plutarch indeed says that this is very much out of character with his earlier demeanor. So this makes a big change in him. And it's almost like, in this account at least, what would you call it in a movie? The inciting incident, the thing that makes Crassus different and leads to his doom, of course.
Yeah, this is just before the third act, really. That's what we're up to now.
Yeah.
So the governor of Syria,
yes,
doesn't explicitly automatically get to attack Parthia.
No, indeed not.
So how does A lead to B lead to F for him?
Yeah, it is 2 and 2 makes 5, isn't it?
Yeah.
But then this is not unknown. Similar things are going to go on with Julius Caesar, aren't they?
I guess so, yeah. He went kiss Alpine Gaul, Britain.
Yeah, go outside your remit. So Parthia is not in his official orders, because, of course, you can't be governor of Parthia, because the Romans have not conquered Parthia. But it's pretty obvious what he's up to. And I think to every Roman in the know at the time, they could see that this is why he would want Syria.
Yeah.
And indeed, Plutarch in the life of Crassus, we're about chapter 16, what I just read out, and here. And yet in the decree which was passed regarding his mission, there was no mention of a Parthian war, but everybody knew that Crassus was all eagerness for this. And Caesar wrote to him from Gaul, approving of his project and inciting him on to war. So one of the other members of the triumvirate is all for it too.
Yeah, okay. So how ambitious was he? Is this going to extend beyond this?
Well, I mean, Parthia is sort of the great enemy, while Caesar is making his name in Gaul, because I guess the Gauls have been a consistent and persistent threat from the north in the Roman psyche. Parthia is the big empire. Gauls are kind of terrifying, but the Parthians have a huge territorial control and riches out in the east. But Crassus isn't just talking about Parthia. He's talking about going all the way to India. So the edges of the known world for the Romans, and even to what Plutarch calls the outer sea, which seems like the rim of the world. There's one kind of construction of the world where it's surrounded by sea. So this is, I think, A, exaggeration, and B, a reflection of Crassus's kind of unbounded ambition here.
But, you know, they had tales at that point, and they weren't even tales of Alexander going to the end of the known world and weeping because there's no more left to conquer. If Crassus can reach that height and kind of fill up his piggy bank on the way, that's an ideal scenario. Pompey did nothing compared to that.
And, yes.
You know? Where's my Magnus kind of thing?
and of course we have had that rivalry from early on. And I guess Pompey and Crassus are a similar generation, whereas Caesar is relatively the young upstart. And he's gone west, but Pompey had made his name in the east. So you can see him again as being the more direct rival, absolutely. it's not just Plutarch who's giving us this version. Cassius Dio, the historian, also stresses that Crassus is both greedy and opportunistic here. He says, this is in Book 40, Chapter 12, Crassus, desiring for his part to accomplish something that involved glory and at the same time profit. So you can do both at once.
Yeah, multitasking.
And seeing that no such thing was possible in Syria. So I've got this province of Syria, but it's a dud. I could milk it dry, but there's no glory. Because in Syria, the people themselves were quiet, says Dio. And those who had formerly warred against the Romans were, by reason of their powerlessness, causing no disturbance. He made a campaign against the Parthians. He had no complaint to bring against them, nor had the war been assigned to him. But he heard that they were exceedingly wealthy and expected that Orodes, who is the Parthian king, would be easy to capture because he was newly established. So he hasn't done his research, basically. And he just thinks, oh, he's a newbie. That won't be hard.
This sounds like a war for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, it really does. This might be a point at which to mention that Orodes has lots of different names in our sources, so it's easy to get confused about him.
Yeah. So there's no existing war with Parthia currently. Mm. So is there opposition to this, going and essentially making trouble for your own glory?
There's such opposition to it and so much recognition that this is obviously what Crassus is up to, that even before he leaves Rome, there is trouble and he needs Pompey's help to get out of Rome.
Oh, he must hate that.
Well, yeah, that, exactly. So there's great opposition because Rome is currently in a treaty with Parthia, and Ateius, one of the tribunes of the plebs, tries to physically stop Crassus. At first, he tries to persuade him, so he uses rhetoric, persuasive language, and then physically restraining him. So Pompey is needed, and it's only partly because the other tribunes think, oh, this kind of physical opposition to Crassus is a bit much, and so they kind of allow Pompey to help him get out. But Ateius, in a brilliant last move, uses a last resort of cursing him. Plutarch says Ateius ran on ahead to the city gate, placed there a blazing brazier, and when Crassus came up, cast incense and libations upon it and invoked curses which were dreadful and terrifying.
Wow. That's spitting on him when he leaves a bit.
Yeah, he was doomed from the start after that. So now he's off. He goes the traditional route of leaving Italy for the east. He leaves from Brundisium. He leaves in winter, which is another ill-advised thing to do because the Mediterranean in winter is quite stormy. Mm. And this means that he loses many ships on the way. But he reaches Galatia, which would have involved partly going over land because it's kind of modern central Turkey. And Plutarch starts commenting on Crassus's age at this point.
At length.
Just over and over and over. He says...
He really labours the point. I feel sorry for Crassus a bit.
Well, do you think he's old for this? He's 60.
Yes, he is. Okay. He's, you know, in Roman terms, yes. Ask me when I'm 60.
I'm not there yet and I already feel much too old for this. And Plutarch lays it into him by saying he looks even older, at least getting someone else to say he looks even older, where in chapter 17 of The Life of Crassus, he writes, finding that King Deiotarus, who was now a very old man, this is in Galatia, that Deiotarus was founding a new city, he rallied him saying, oh, king, you are beginning to build at the 12th hour. The Galatian laughed and said, but you yourself, Imperator, as I see, are not marching very early in the day against the Parthians. Oh, what wit. So they're jibing each other for trying to accomplish anything later in life.
Yeah.
Terrible ageism.
It is, but, you know, in some ways, valid point. I mean, he is waiting till very long in his life to do this, but I suppose he didn't have the opportunity. He didn't have an enemy. He's trying to do it while he can.
You know, having been in the game for so long, and he's had opportunities sort of for glory. You know, he has more or less beaten Spartacus.
Who's a slave.
Yeah. But, you know, it was a formidable army and very difficult and underrated. But yes, it's an enslaved army.
And the social wars, which were Romans.
Yes.
And so this is the kind of military conquests that he's had. Yes. Nothing against a worthy enemy.
Mm.
And so he sees this as his last chance.
A foreign
chance.
Enemy.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Conquest, foreign enemy. But there is in our sources a degree of, well, he had to kind of pick the fight because they wouldn't have been an enemy otherwise, idea going on. it's a desperation and it's very late for him to be doing this.
Okay, so take us through the weeds a bit. What happens with Crassus and his campaign?
Well, it starts fairly promisingly, sort of. He crosses the Euphrates, which I guess is a big symbolic part of this journey because mm-hmm. it's a kind of vast Mesopotamian river. So, you know, that crossing, that transfer over to the territory that you're going to declare battle in. And there are some early victories. Now, these aren't Parthians as such because the first city he comes across, it's called Zenodotia, which is a Greek colony. But there's a symbolism in the fact that it surrenders easily to Crassus's army. And as would usually happen, request a garrison to look after them.
Mm.
So Crassus sends 100 soldiers. However, at night, the people of Zenodotia take the soldiers by surprise and execute them. So that's a declaration of war against the Romans.
Mm.
Crassus sacks and destroys the city in retaliation, and he sells the people into slavery. His men hail him as imperator after this victory. And Plutarch thinks this is, I guess this is building on the Crassus's victories aren't proper ones narrative.
Well, this shows a lack of judgment for just sending his 100 men in there and just blindly trusting. But then again, you know, who could have seen this treachery?
I feel like a lot of what the information we get about Crassus is he never reads the room properly.
Yeah.
And I feel like, and it's very hard for me not to stray over to Caesar all the time, but I'll try to keep it to a minimum, that most of our sources, some of which are written by Caesar, of course, present Caesar as someone who, at least until the assassination, knows what's going on.
Yeah.
Knows what the enemy is thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas Crassus just hasn't got that.
Theatre of Pompey, one room that Caesar didn't read very well.
Yeah, it's true. Don't go into the theatre of your enemy. Okay, so back to Crassus.
Yes, Crassus.
Plutarch, whom you've called judgy here, and I think you're right, says, thereby, in other words, being hailed as imperator, as general, for this victory against these... They've risen up against the 100 men left there, but they're not an enemy army. And that's what you'd normally be hailed as imperator for defeating an enemy army. So Plutarch says, thereby incurring much disgrace and showing himself of a paltry spirit. This is a great translation. And without good hope for the greater struggles that lay before him. All right. If you think that that is worthy of imperator, wait till you face a proper army, is what Plutarch's saying.
Yes.
Since he, Crassus, was so delighted with a trifling acquisition.
Yeah. Brackets, judgy Plutarch 17, my official reference.
Yes, yeah, indeed. And again, it's because Plutarch knows what's coming, but it's still a great read, you know, and also a really fantastic translation of that. So after this sort of victory, Crassus withdraws back to Syria, back to his safe space for winter.
So back across the river?
Yeah.
Wow, okay. Back to Syria.
He's waiting for his son to arrive. Yes, indeed, he's crossed back over the river, which seems like going backwards.
Yeah.
And indeed, Plutarch seems to agree. This isn't a great idea. He calls it his first blunder because he's made his presence known.
He's kicked the ant nest and left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the enemy now has time to prepare for a real conflict.
Mm.
I mean, the obvious thing to say is the element of surprise completely gone now.
So at this point, so I guess he's in Syria, back where he should be, if I can put it that way. When he is coming out of the Temple of Venus, bad omen here. First, the youthful Crassus, which is Publius, stumbled and fell at the gate, and then his father fell over him. Which just, you know, I guess if you fall when you're coming out of the stairs of the temple...
I mean, it has comedy effect. It's slapstick.
Not to the Romans, though.
Oh, no.
No, this is an omen, and this is one that is ignored. This is a bad tiding because you let the Parthians prepare for war.
Mm. Mm. And look, stumbling is always seen as something that presages some kind of, well, literal fall, I guess.
Mm.
A literal fall presaging a metaphorical one. But falling over his son, that seems like an extra layer of it's going to be bad for both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the Temple of Venus, and, you know, Venus, well, what is she associated with by this point as Pompey builds his Temple of Venus Victrix, the victor back in Rome?
Okay. Pompey having a kind of an influence.
Let's overread into the text.
Yeah,
yes.
Sure. Yeah. So while he's wintering in Syria, he gets visited by envoys from the king of Parthia.
Mm-hmm. These are envoys from, Plutarch here names him as Arsaces, but this is very confusing because in the next paragraph, Plutarch will call him Herodes, and he's the same chap that we talked about earlier called Orodes. He's
okay.
Orodes the Second, and this seems to be what the Parthians themselves called him. He'd had an interesting path to power. We mentioned he recently came to power. He did this by ganging together with his brother to murder their father, and then he turned on his brother and killed him.
Lovely.
Nice chap.
Yep.
Maybe not somebody to be taken lightly. Anyway, the envoys say that if Crassus is there for himself, i.e. this isn't an official act of war on the part of the Romans, you know, the king will go easy on them. To quote, Arsaces would act with moderation, would take pity on the old age of Crassus. Mm. There it is again. Crassus replies, this is a bit arrogant, I'm afraid, they'll get their answer in Seleucia. So this is a Parthian city, a major Parthian city. You'll know when I come and invade your city, is what he's saying.
Yeah, yeah.
But they don't take him seriously. They kind of ridicule him. They've already kind of attacked his age. Orodes II is young and vigorous and murderous. So, you know, he doesn't take the opportunity that he could have had. You feel like the way this narrative works out is there are all these opportunities for Crassus to just step back a bit.
Mm.
And at each opportunity, you know, there's an omen against him. The envoys give him a way out. He doesn't take that opportunity. He's just walking to his doom.
Yeah, this is kind of like, you know, the offer to be taken off the hook, a threat and a kind of a ridicule all in the one message, which I've got to appreciate how involved it is for one sentence. Yay, Parthians. But at the same time, Crassus can't back down on that.
Mm.
Crassus is given a good line in return here,
mm-hmm.
but isn't taken seriously.
Mm.
I can kind of see all as being very realistic in that exchange.
Yeah. And of course, it would be a good line if he came out as victor.
Put the kettle on for me and wait.
Yeah. you know?
I'll have a cuppa when I arrive. Stoke me a clipper, I'll be back for Christmas.
Nobody would get that reference. We can't leave that in.
There will be plenty of people who will hear that and go, oh, Matt and Rhiannon are kindred spirits. I bet you a select few of our audience will feel seen.
Do you think that they'd be mostly in the UK and Australia, or are there Americans who've seen Red Dwarf as well?
Write in, everyone. emperorspodcast@gmail.com. Stoke us a clipper.
Okay. If only Crassus had said that. But instead, he goes on to, in Plutarch's version of this at least, to ignore yet more omens.
And more omens.
That I haven't written out, but I feel like...
Oh, she's handing a tablet across to me. Where am I looking at? Plutarch, Life of Crassus, 19, etc. The place where he was intending to encamp was also smitten by two thunderbolts. Oh. And one of the general's horses, richly caparisoned, I don't know what that word is.
Oh, God. It just means decorated.
Okay. Violently dragged its groom along with it into the river and disappeared beneath the waves. Wow, okay. That's very Tolkien.
Well, it's a bit Lacus Curtius as well, isn't it? Early Roman myth where he dives into the hole in the forum on his horse as a kind of sacrifice for Rome.
Mm. Well, Tolkien had to get it from somewhere. Mm. So, yes. It is said also that the first eagle, which was raised aloft, faced about on its own accord.
I didn't know standards could turn around on their own, but apparently they can.
When there's wind. Mm. Besides all this, it happened that their rations were distributed to the soldiers after the crossing of the river. Lentils and salt came first, which are held by the Romans to be tokens of mourning and set out as offerings to the dead. Well, that's just bad taste and poor catering. Here, you read a bit now.
I've got the Penguin translation here by Rex Warner. Crassus, when he was addressing the troops, let fall a phrase that had a most frightening effect on the men. This is, I propose to break down the bridge so that not a single one of you can get back. Of course, he should have corrected himself as soon as he realized how ill-chosen his words were, and should, seeing his hearers so alarmed, have explained what he really meant. But he was too stubborn and obstinate to do so.
So there's this last bit here. And finally, when he was making the customary sacrifice of purification for the army, and the seer placed the viscera in his hands, he let them fall to the ground. Then, seeing that the bystanders were beyond measure distressed at the occurrence, he smiled and said, such is old age, but no weapon, you may be sure, shall fall from its hands. So again, he's old and his hands are shaky. Mm-hmm. So that's another ageism comment there from Plutarch, with Crassus clearly acknowledging it now, but probably a bit sick of it all.
Yeah, and saying that it's not affecting him where it really matters, that in battle he can still hold his sword.
Yeah. So Crassus and his troops are engaging in battle, and the battle that we know a lot about at this point is taken as the major defeat and what stops the campaign, really. And this is a battle against the Parthians at a place called Carrhae. So what can you tell me about this battle?
Well, it starts badly for Crassus because he thinks that he's got some really good intel from an Osroene chieftain called Ariamnes. He has an association with Rome, and I think he kind of uses this to kind of get in with Crassus because he had helped Pompey. It's like Pompey is there at the end in spirit, isn't he?
Pompey also tripped him over in front of the temple in spirit, don't forget.
Ariamnes had helped Pompey in Pompey's eastern campaigns, where Pompey had made his name and gained all of his glory.
Mm.
And so he uses this association with Pompey as his in with Crassus. And he's drawn as a very persuasive guy in Plutarch's account. We're told he lauded Pompey as his benefactor and complimented Crassus on his forces. So just rub the ego of Crassus. But in fact, this guy is not to be trusted by the Romans because he is now in the pay of the Parthians. And he tells Crassus that this is the time to attack because the Parthians are just in disarray. They're very badly organized. And so if you hurry into battle, you'll get them off guard. You know, and of course, they're completely ready. And Plutarch adds, Crassus had better information from elsewhere. The previous intel he had received had told him that this was not the case, that the Parthians were ready, that he shouldn't rush, that he should go more slowly. So he's too eager to get there, to get this victory. He wants to believe what Ariamnes tells him, and so he believes it.
So that shows a weakness of his judgment there.
Absolutely.
Which we've seen this whole campaign through, really.
And it means that he's doing everything at the wrong time. Something that keeps recurring about Crassus's life. Everything is always out of time. You know, he crosses the sea at the wrong time. He does it to himself as well. He brings it on and he's going into battle at the wrong time. So he leaves his troops, the troops and Crassus are led, presumably by Ariamnes, into the desert. There's nothing for them. You know, there's no water, importantly. There's no shade, there's no trees. As Plutarch puts it, no trees, no water, no limit anywhere which the eye could reach. Literally is in a very inhospitable place.
And the Romans are out of their element in this sort of environment and are probably ill-prepared by the sounds of it.
Whereas the Parthians, they know this territory intimately. And this means that the troops, they're worn down by attacks from these Parthians who have archers who are on horseback and on camels, and they're just better equipped for this kind of territory and this kind of conflict.
Yeah.
Crassus' son, Publius, is injured and ends up taking his own life so that he's not caught, presumably. Publius declaring that no death could have such terrors for him as to make him desert those who were perishing on his account, ordered them to save their own lives, bade them farewell, and dismissed them. So Publius is given this kind of heroic end. The surviving men manage to make it to Carrhae. They are forced to leave many wounded behind who are all slaughtered by the Parthians. They're not taken captive.
Yeah, these numbers are really kind of fluid when you're talking about battles this long ago and these kind of accounts. But the number that I've got here is that the Romans had 35,000 plus men.
Mm-hmm.
The Parthians had 10,000. The Romans lost about 30,000 men. So that's just a massive defeat.
Yes. And it feels like it wasn't even that difficult. Well, clearly from the disparity of losses, it's not that difficult.
And Crassus loses his son. So he's had a massive defeat. His son Publius dies. Mm. If Crassus had died in this battle, then it would have come across as a noble end, much like Spartacus in his final battle, dying against the enemy with a sword in his hand. Even Crassus didn't come away like that. And it was his son who did that.
Mm-hmm.
So Crassus, meanwhile, gets back to the camp.
So the Parthian general, who's called Surena, offers to meet Crassus to have peace talks. Surena, Plutarch has suggested, has been underestimated by Crassus too as a kind of secondary force. The king hasn't come himself.
Mm.
But, you know, yet again, Crassus was wrong.
Yeah.
Crassus agrees to meet with him. When he's getting on his horse, one of his officers suspects a trap and grabs Crassus's horse's reins. This leads to confusion, and a fight comes out of this, ensues with the Parthians present, and all the Romans are killed. This includes Crassus. So this is a very ignominious end that's come from sort of just confusion. The officer just thinking something's wrong. Maybe it was a trap, but the fact that he's seems to have interjected violently starts this skirmish, and that's Crassus's end. So as you say, it's not in battle at the hand of the enemy or his own hand. It's just sort of this weird
thing that happened.
This weird accident almost.
Yeah.
It's a brawl. Now, Dio, it isn't very clear to him exactly what's happened, so he gives us alternatives. That Crassus was killed either by one of his own men to prevent his capture alive, or by the enemy because he was badly wounded. So it's not even clear which side has killed him.
Mm.
Now, this is the famous bit. Dio continues and gives us the sort of famous version of Crassus's end, which is gory, I guess.
Mm.
Deeply unpleasant. He says, and the Parthians, as some say, which is a sure indication that he's not really sure whether to believe it, as some say, the Parthians poured molten gold into Crassus's mouth in mockery. For though a man of vast wealth, he had set so great store by money as to pity those who could not support an enrolled legion from their own means, regarding them as poor men. So he looks down on people who don't have money, so the Parthians feed him money at the end.
Yeah.
And I think the myth that's come out of that is that Crassus is killed by having this molten gold poured into his mouth, but it's not. It's much more.
Look,
every day.
Yeah, before I waded into this to make notes, I was of the impression that he died by...
It's a much better story.
It is, I guess.
It's very Game of Thrones.
Yes, it is. I think that might have happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
They're ripping off Crassus.
Yeah.
If it happened after his death, or even if it isn't, the fact that the story is there tells us that this remains the kind of defining characteristic of Crassus, that this would have been a worthy thing to do to someone who was so greedy and so rich. Plutarch gives us a slightly different version of Crassus's body being attacked. He says the head and the hands are cut off and sent to Orodes, sent to the king, who's in Armenia. And that they find a Roman prisoner who looks like Crassus. They put him in a dress and hold a fake triumph to mock him.
Okay, so they go, this is the great Crassus dressed in a dress, and this is the triumph you deserve.
Mm. So there's a kind of inversion of a Roman ritual, a Roman parade of victory. They really want to have a go at him. And of course, the indignity to the body of removing these body parts and the proof that he is dead. He also says, and he says this at some length right at the end of his life of Crassus, Plutarch says that in later years, the head was used at a Parthian royal wedding. Because what do you not want at a royal wedding but the head of some long dead Roman warrior?
Mm.
And it's used as a prop in a performance of Euripides' Bacchae, which is a play that involves the king of Thebes, Pentheus, being torn apart by his family members who are in a frenzy, driven mad by Bacchus, who think that he's an animal. They tear him to pieces and then they wake up and find that they've killed their own son, nephew, and ends with their distress. So the fact that this Roman general's head might have ended up being just a prop in a play... Well, it's a real final indignity.
It just shows how little regard they had for him, I suppose. He wasn't a worthy enemy to fight.
Mm. Well, I don't know. They kind of had a triumph against him, a sort of triumph.
That was just mocking, yeah. That's the end of Crassus. So Rome didn't take this as being something that they need to visit retribution over, by the sounds of it. They never go and attack Parthia in an all-out war. There are kind of plans that Caesar has when he dies of going across and...
And Mark Antony's going to have a Parthian campaign. Oh, no, that it's there. It's always going round in their minds. But the Romans get a bit distracted by other things for a couple of decades, don't they?
Yeah.
Like fighting themselves.
Yes. Too much going on for Rome
to
avenge somebody who went so willingly to their fate.
And Herodes isn't going to, you know, he's not going to be around for that much longer.
Mm.
By the time the Romans get themselves together, Herodes is gone anyway. But what does rankle for the Romans is, well, Carrhae is bad. Huge losses, death of a big general,
mm-hmm.
huge defeat, very undignified.
Very undignified.
And they have captured Roman standards.
Mm.
Plutarch doesn't really go on about this, but this is what remains as the great humiliation for the Romans. So who gets the Roman standards back?
Augustus, doesn't he?
Yes.
Augustus's son?
Well, they are apparently handed over to Tiberius. We think that's what happens. And that is depicted on?
The statue that's in the Vatican Museum.
The Augustus of the Prima Porta.
There you go.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's on this big propaganda statue, the handing back. And he represents it in his achievements, the res gestae.
Didn't realise there'd be a quiz at the end of this episode.
But... Well, they should be at the end of every episode, I think. only if I'm asking the questions. He represents it as close to a triumphant act, whereas in fact he probably negotiated.
Yes, yes. Okay, so I'm bringing this back to Crassus. Mm. Does this ending end the myth of Crassus as well?
I think that historians and even Plutarch tell Crassus as a bit of a warning tale that this is where greed gets you.
Mm.
This is where underrating your enemy gets you. And also, he's always the third wheel in that unofficial triumvirate, right? So much more is written. I mean, he couldn't know what Pompey and Caesar would go on to do, but so much more gets written about them. They go on to have civil war against each other and Caesar will emerge triumphant and become dictator, whereas Crassus is gone by this point. And Crassus being gone is kind of important to that subsequent history. If Crassus had lived, then maybe the triumvirate wouldn't have fallen apart. Although it was already under threat. You know, Crassus dies in 53. Julia had died in the previous year in 54. And she, Pompey's wife, Caesar's daughter, had sort of been part of the holding that together. But Crassus dying is kind of the final death knell.
I feel that Crassus would have been on the side of Caesar. I still think that things would have fallen apart. And I don't know how much longer he would have lasted, but he would have been a voice in amongst all of that.
Well, from the Roman point of view, victory in Parthia would have given him enormous authority, even more wealth than he can already dream of. And he, as we've seen, he already has a huge amount of wealth. I just think that would have made him so overwhelmingly powerful. Who knows? We might not have... I think you're right. The triumvirate is not going to last forever. But maybe the power partnership of Caesar and Crassus... We can't know. It's all hypothetical.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe if Crassus had survived, well, definitely if Crassus had survived and won in Parthia, we would have got a different version of that outcome, but maybe it would have been civil war anyway.
That was Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe, leave a review, and tell your friends about it. You can find us in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any readily available podcatching platform. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook. You can also follow us on Blue Sky. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. This podcast has been recorded at the Bundoora campus of La Trobe University on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.